ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
On the front line of America's immigration wars, religious leaders face off against agents of the Trump administration. Hello there, this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. And that story is coming up. Australia's landmark ban on people under 16 using social media begins next month. It's the first time any government in the world has taken such a step to shield children from social media, especially those online predators who use the platforms. But is the new law really comprehensive? Are there holes in it? Melinda Tankard-Reist heads the advocacy group Collective Shout. She's also a member of the federal government's stakeholder advisory panel. Melinda, welcome. Are there holes in the law? Is it comprehensive enough?
This isn't about denying children access to social media. It's really about stopping social media's access to children. For years, we have been documenting big tech companies acting like rogue states. We have documented how these mega corporations facilitate and enable predatory and grooming behaviors, sexualization, eroticization, sexual harassment directed at minors, how the platforms have acted as gateways to pornography and commercially mediated the abuse of children and haven't been transparent or accountable. So we need governments to step in and provide this layer of protection between children and sexual predators, groomers, scammers, and cyberbullies. So yes, we welcome the move. You know, for too long, the vested interests of the big tech bros have been put before the welfare of children, and it's time to stop that.
And you've made actually a powerful enemy, and I'll ask you about that in a moment. But yes, you have been campaigning for many years against the predatory elements of the online world. Just remind us, without being too explicit, but just remind us of what you saw on social media, which is the subject of this restriction, that raised your concern.
Well, at Collective Shout, we were documenting for years the way the world's biggest tech corporations were allowing and facilitating predation and exploitation, abuse, grooming and trafficking, body hatred, mental health decline. We actually documented, for example, that Instagram was essentially a predator's playground. Predators were grooming children on that platform, engaging them in chats, engaging them in live streamed videos. And Meta did nothing about it. Meta, the parent company of Instagram. We've been following the online grooming of children for years. We have documented how children are mostly introduced to pornography through social media. We've demonstrated that these platforms are inherently unsafe. They are run by harmful industries that have not cared about the well-being of children. We have new evidence that's just come out as a result of a lawsuit representing 1,800 plaintiffs against Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, and YouTube in the US that found that millions of adult strangers were contacting minors on its sites, that its products exacerbated mental health issues in teens, and that content relating to eating disorders, suicide, and child sexual abuse was frequently detected, yet rarely removed. They knew what was going on, but they did it anyway because more usage meant more profits from the company. These companies were pursuing a strategy of growth at all costs and ignoring the impact of their products on children's well-being. dramatic increase in self-harm in girls, for example.
Yeah, I was going to say, Melinda, I mean, you do a lot of workshops in secondary schools, particularly with young women. What was the result of their constant exposure to social media, particularly when it came to how they thought of themselves?
Making them hate themselves, increases in anxiety, depression, self-harm in 10 to 14-year-old girls increased by 189% since they had access to devices and social media. They're always comparing themselves to the highly photoshopped and perfected images of women that they see. But I help girls to understand that this is how the algorithms work. Mm. It's by design. For example, a girl only needs to watch a couple of seconds of a TikTok video like Fitspo, Thinspo, My Day on a Plate, Skinny Tok. If they just watch a few seconds, they don't even have to like it or comment on it. They will be bombarded with that similar content. That's the way the algorithms work. It's by design. They're seeing Instagram influencers every day in their feeds. There's about 500,000 of them. And the research shows that only 10 to 15 minutes exposure causes a girl's mood to go down. And that's because the Instagram influencer needs to sell products. That's how they make their money. Mm.
There's one platform, I believe, that you are still worried about. I don't think it's included in this new social media age restriction. I think it's called Roblox. What is that?
Well, Roblox is a very popular gaming platform for children, being used to approach children, to groom them. Roblox has been called out quite significantly in the last year for facilitating predation, large volumes of predators on that platform. But, you know, it's not just one platform. You know, there's no safe platform for children because the platforms haven't cared. They have put their profits above the well-being, especially of children. Finally, they're being exposed for that. But there needs to be real penalties against them. They would rather pay the fines than actually change the way that they operate. It's cheaper for them to pay the fines. They need, you know, meaningful penalties, and they need to be forced to implement a digital duty of care so that we're not playing, you know, whack-a-mole every day.
Yeah, I've read data where children are spending up to 2.5 hours a day on these gaming platforms. Why are they not included in the social media restrictions?
Unfortunately, some of the platforms argued that they weren't technically social media, but we argued that if they operate like social media, they should be included in the ban. However, some other platforms have been recently added, such as Twitch, but we will continue to push for an expansion of the age of access and who gets included. You know, the world is looking at Australia now. This is a pioneering laws designed to keep social media companies from preying on children for their own profits and enabling grooming and sexualized bullying and image-based sexual abuse and porn. We think that these other big tech corporations should be put on notice.
I mean, I've got to say, though, you're not afraid to pick a fight. I noticed that the world's second richest man, Elon Musk, joined an attack on you because you campaigned to have two gaming platforms. I think they're called Steam and itch.io, remove certain content. You know, a gaming platform, people might think it's, you know, Space Invaders. Not what you found. What did you find?
Oh, we found thousands of rape and incest and sexual torture games being accessible to any ages. These are 3D simulation games, highly realistic. We believe that these gaming platforms were normalising rape and incest as entertainment and were contributing to real-world, real-life violence against women and girls. So we took on those platforms through the credit card and payment gateways, which were profiting from facilitating their transactions. As a result, we have been subjected to an almost four-month-long campaign of misogynist cyber terror with rape and death threats, murder threats, being turned into porn, being sent child sexual exploitation material, threats against our families, being doxxed, being sexually harassed. We have withstood that for the last 4 months, but they won't stop us. You know, we're seasoned campaigners and we'll keep going. We're celebrating our 42nd victory this year. This is a record number of wins. We're not going anywhere, and we'll keep campaigning for a world free of sexploitation.
Good to speak to you again. Melinda Tankard-Reist, she's the movement director at Collective Shout, a women and girls advocacy group. Melinda was also a member of the Stakeholder Advisory Board, which advised the government over its trial of age verification and age limits. Thank you very much for coming back to the program, Melinda.
Thanks so much for having me once again, Andrew.
And at our website, you can find a link to the eSafety Commissioner's webpage, which has resources to help parents manage the new law. And you're on ABC Radio National, hearing about the links between religion, ethics, and the news that shapes the world. One of the Trump administration's most divisive policies is the mass raids by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, also known as ICE. About 65,000 people, not all of them undocumented immigrants, are now in detention. Some of the most dramatic confrontations have occurred in Chicago, where religious leaders have been protesting. One of them is Baptist minister Michael Wolfe of the Lake Street Church in Evanston.
I was there with over 100 faith leaders who had gathered to really raise their voice against what winds up being a concentration camp or a black site right in America, where we know that torture is happening to detainees. Basically, there's been the construction or fabrication of a secret police in ICE and Immigrations and Customs Enforcement here, who comes into our communities, kidnaps people, and takes them to a place where there's only one meal a day. There's unsanitary conditions. There's no access to medical care. And there's no access to spiritual care either. And so I was there with those spiritual leaders who wanted to demand that we could actually be able to give spiritual care to the folks who are detained there. And also we wanted to demand the closure of the facility and the release of the detainees there, because we know the conditions are torture.
When you say that the conditions are torture, I gather what you mean there is the inadequate food, the unsanitary conditions, that these fall below any normal human rights threshold.
Absolutely. I mean, it's completely dehumanizing what's happening in that facility. It's against the law of the United States, which, as you know, is not exactly the most followed thing in the world in this current administration. So there's not a lot of folks who are actually care, but it's definitely unlawful what's happening there too.
Why have these deportation raids, particularly in Chicago, ended up so violent? Because this is the pushback and the response from the Trump administration. They are answering violence with, yes, a heavy-handed response.
So every protest that I've been at, especially a protest led by faith leaders, there's been no violence. What I can say is that immediately we are met with physical assault and violence. I've been met with physical violence several times. In a photo that I'm sure some of your viewers have seen, I am grabbed after having told folks that I mean them absolutely no harm, that we're peaceably assembled, and I'm slammed to the ground and treated quite roughly. I want to keep the focus on the detainees. How I'm treated is 1/100th or 1/1000th of what goes on in that facility. But all the violence I've ever experienced has been from ICE agents, and it's also been from Illinois State Police, but it's been from law enforcement officials who are part of this administration. But a narrative that says that faith leaders are somehow out there being violent, it's fatuous.
How many people are being rounded up? Who is being rounded up, Michael?
People, normal people who are members of our communities are being kidnapped. I think it's hard for viewers to understand what it's like to live in a culture of fear. But what happens is ICE comes and they will kidnap your neighbor who has been here for 20 years. They will take them to a black site. They'll take them to a place with absolutely no supervision, and you will never hear from them again. When you try to say that this is wrong, then ICE will tear gas you and your neighbors who have come out. Even though you have done no violence and you have done nothing, they will enact violence. They will cause car crashes and drag people out of the car crash. I want to be very specific and clear for our listeners and for folks who are hearing about this. These are people who are masked. They have absolutely no identifying characteristics. There's no name badge. There's no way to file a complaint. This is the establishment of secret police. And if it were happening in your community, I dare say that you might be a tad bit upset and you might take action.
Yeah, when you say these people, residents in the United States, are being kidnapped, I understand why you would say that. I mean, is the government, though, actually kidnapping them? Don't they say that they're undocumented immigrants? They've lived under the radar for a long time, but the clock is now ticking. I'm just anticipating their response to the idea that these are people sure. being kidnapped.
First of all, they have detained American citizens quite frequently, if you look at the statistics. And a judge recently ordered the release of about 700 different detainees in Chicagoland because of unlawful procedures. It's called kidnapping because there's not due process being followed. Mm. We live in a country of laws in which people have certain unalienable rights in the United States, just as much as they have in Australia. The fact that it's kidnapping is the extrajudicial nature of it. People are operating outside the law with complete impunity. And that is what makes it a terrifying experience.
I'm very taken by a comment that you made a moment ago. You said this is a spiritual emergency. The United States is still, of all the Western and global North countries, the most religious. That really resonates. Why is it a spiritual emergency, Michael?
I think that it's a spiritual emergency because we're facing and looking squarely at dehumanization in action. When we see what's happening, it's a moral and spiritual emergency, and it demands a response. It's a question for every person of faith, and it's not just Christians, it's people of all faiths. What are we going to do in response when we see dehumanization, when we see tyranny, when we see things that violate our ethical standards? Will we act? Or will we simply say, I guess it's okay because the government is doing it? For me and for other people of faith, it's a spiritual emergency. For me specifically, I want to talk about the fact that I have to act as if Jesus is locked in Broadview, because my faith talks about how we treat the vulnerable, whether what we do for them and what we withhold from them. This is the standard of our faith, and it's what we do or withhold from God. For me, that's from Matthew 25 in the Christian perspective. There are other faith traditions who have different ideas about how we treat the most vulnerable, but the best of every faith tradition says that the most vulnerable folks are the most deserving of our care, and how we treat them is going to really determine what kind of people of faith we are. So it's absolutely a spiritual emergency.
You've painted a very vivid picture of what people who are being detained by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency are going through. I wonder also, what effect are these raids having on the ICE agents themselves? Their argument will be, we are simply following the orders that we have been given lawfully, as far as they can tell, by their superiors. What effect is it having on those men and women?
I've made a couple of law enforcement officers, some of the ICE agents, cry by asking them, where are the children that they have abducted? And why would they participate in this? Listen, ICE offers fantastic bonuses and a lot of money to do evil acts, but that doesn't excuse them. So there's a moral erosion that's taking place. And some of these officers, all these officers are people. They have moral choices to make, and they have to be approached as moral actors. And they have to be told what you're doing is complicity with evil, and you have a choice to make. But I want to tell you about the corrosive effects of the choices you're making when you choose to be complicit with this kind of thing.
I only ask about that because 20 years ago, I did stories about the young men who were being recruited to fight in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they were disproportionately from very poor backgrounds. This was the only option they had. I wonder whether many of these ICE officers were in similar positions.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we call that economic conscription. That's the term that I would refer to that as. I'm familiar with that, and I think that's absolutely true. And there's a reason why this moral injury, that's another way to talk about it, is being imposed on these officers from poor backgrounds with no choice in some way, economic choice. My task is to remind them that it's not only about money, that there are some things that are not worth it no matter what. Scripture talks about how what profit comes to a person if they gain the whole world, but they lose their soul. And that's really the perspective that I bring to it.
Baptist minister Michael Wolfe of the Lake Street Church in Evanston, which is just north of Chicago. And you're with me, Andrew West. Indian Americans are one of the fastest growing immigrant communities in the U.S., But a fracture has opened within the community over the role of Hindu faith and identity. Some Indian Americans are pushing back against Hindutva, which is a form of religious nationalism. It's increasingly present in Indian politics. But it's the campus of Rutgers University in New Jersey that's become a flashpoint. Richa Karmarkar of the Religion News Service has been covering the story.
The Hindu population now in America stands at more than 3.5 million, which is about 1% of the U.S.'s entire population. And the majority of these Hindus are actually from India. They are still immigrants to India, first generation. And so we have first, second, and third generations now here. And the majority of Hindus are centered in states like California, Texas, New York, New Jersey. They have very high Hindu populations in these states.
Is there at times, though, some tension between elements of the Hindu community and the broader American Indian community?
Yeah, I would say the tensions, given that the majority of Hindus in America are still immigrants and they have a direct tie to India still, I think the majority of conflict comes in the support of the Indian government, primarily the Hindu nationalist BJP that's in power and the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. That, as well as caste, the discussions around caste and how prevalent caste discrimination is in the United States, those really divide Hindus and Indian Americans and, you know, conservative versus progressive Hindus. We're seeing a lot of divisions, especially, you know, among Hindus and the Sikh American community as well.
Why does the question of caste, and you've written about this extensively, persist, though, as an issue in the United States?
Since 1965, when Indians came to this country in large numbers, research says that the majority of them were kind of a more privileged background, and that means, you know, a higher caste, per se. That has come to the attention of the greater America now, where, as I said, we have multiple generations coming in. We have Indians of all types, you know, not necessarily high earning, high educated Indians. It's coming now to the forefront in discussions at college campuses, at workplaces, where Indians, inter-Indians, are having issues with caste bias. We've seen now in the past few years a number of workplaces and universities that have sought to address caste discrimination and really outlaw it in their existing discrimination policies, and basically just telling, you know, Indian American communities that are suffering from caste discrimination that they are heard and that, you know, they will be included in the list of discrimination policies.
The center of one of these recent disputes has been Rutgers University. You wrote a very interesting piece on the tension there. We'll put a link to it at our website. What happened there to make it a flashpoint for this debate about Hindutva, the nationalist ideology that some Hindus embrace?
So Rutgers is a state university in New Jersey. And as I said before, New Jersey is has one of the most densely populated South Asian communities. Rutgers also enrolls hundreds of Indian international students as well. Here at Rutgers, there was an academic panel called Hindutva in America. And this panel was based on a report of the same name that really was focused on the ways that Hindu nationalism shows up in America, namely through organizations, this report named the Hindu American Foundation, Coalition of Hindus of North America, which are two very large, very prominent Hindu organizations in the United States, as Hindutva-supporting far-right organizations. Of course, these organizations had something to say about this report and the panel as well, arguing that though it is an academic panel, it is ideologically biased, that it was painting, you know, all Hindus as Hindu nationalists or equating the religion with this political ideology. And they really made a stir about it. I think that this panel really just came at a time where Hindus in America are really discussing this idea of Hindu phobia and what that means. And so many of these Hindu advocates who may actually support Hindu nationalism, they would say that Hindu phobia in this case is targeting Hindus and saying that they are, you know, proxies for the Indian government, or that, you know, any Hindu worship is aligned with Hindutva.
And I think, Risha, we should point out, I mean, Hindutva is a very specific nationalist ideology. A lot of Indians do object to it because it seems to imply that unless you are Hindu, you're not fully Indian. Now, is that debate showing up? You've said it's showing up on campuses. Is it showing up in American politics?
Yeah, absolutely. I think India is a very important potential ally to the United States. Again, you mentioned how prominent Indians and Hindu Americans have become at the national level. This is especially important when we are talking about the relationship with India, especially when we talk about Indian immigration, which is a huge hot topic at this moment, where we are seeing very explicit anti-Indian rhetoric surrounding H-1B recipients. We are seeing just how important a positive relationship with India would be to Trump and to America. And so
let's just go across the Hudson River, though. On the other side of the river is New York City, which now has a mayor-elect, Zoram Mamdani. Mamdani has a very interesting background. He's of both Shia Muslim background, but I think his mother is of Hindu background as well. He comes from the diaspora community in Uganda. How did the Indian American community in New York, and particularly the Hindu community, react to Mamdani's candidacy in the first place, given that there are tensions in India itself between some Hindu and Muslim communities?
Yeah, exactly. His mother is Meera Nair, who's a very prominent Indian filmmaker. He has been very vocal about being raised by a Hindu mother and, you know, still following Islam. He holds Hindu traditions close to his heart. He has said he feels at home in temples, is what he said also. Hindus in New York are divided in the way that they see Mamdani. In particular, the immigrant communities that reside in Queens, New York, which is where the majority of Hindus live in New York, for the most part, have welcomed him, you know, with open arms. These are not even necessarily Indian Hindus by direct ancestry. These are Indo-Caribbean Hindus, Nepali Hindus, Bangladeshi Hindus. These are people who, you know, see themselves in him as an immigrant from Uganda, and they are very supportive of his run. At the same time, there are Hindus, you know, from the Indian community, also from the Bangladeshi community, who view him as someone who is Hindu-phobic, they would say, as he has spoken out against India and Prime Minister Modi quite a bit. He has talked about the pogrom in Gujarat, where his family originally comes from. He's talked about anti-Muslim rhetoric that has really proliferated under Modi. Mamdani has made it very clear that regardless of what he supports or who supports Modi, he is a mayor of New York, and, you know, he'll support, or he will serve all Hindu New Yorkers' interests, no matter what.
That's Richa Karmarkar of the Religion News Service. And that's almost it for this episode. Before the year is out, though, I hope to bring you an interview with Anthony Cronman, the Yale University professor and author of an acclaimed new book called True Conservatism. Now, he takes to task, one or two names that you might recognize. He says that true conservatism is the antidote to arrogance and self-centeredness. But that's it for this episode. You can follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. A big thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and Mickey Grossman. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.